Okay, we're beginning here by the Gemara on the Dapa Mem Dalet Amud Aleph. The Gemara here is going to go through each piece of the Mishnah. The Mishnah went through different aspects of Halacha, whereby in the first part of the Mishnah it discussed a girl that reaches one day old. What type of impact that does that have in terms of Halachot related to her? And then similarly in the latter half of the Mishnah, we spoke about a boy that reaches a day old and the Halachic impact of being a day old, what changes and what status changes happen. So the first thing that the Mishnah mentioned was that a tinoket bat yom echad can be tamei tumat nida. And the Gemara says about that, minahane milei. How do we know that that's the case? We learned this back on Daf Lamed Bet, the Tanur Banan, isha, ein li ala isha. The word isha is used to introduce the parshia of nida. It says, v'isha ki tiezava, dam yezova bivsara, shivat yamim tie benidata. So the word isha usually implies a woman of age. But, how do I know that someone less than that age also is subject to the dinim of nida? That was the vav that we learned. The extra vav of ve isha is a ribui. And therefore, we include not only an isha, a woman of age, but even a woman below that age. And as the Mishnah notes, that's even from a day old. Bad yud yamim leziva. That a woman can become a zavak dola at 10 days old. Mishnah notes, we discussed yesterday that that's because it's impossible to become a zavak dola before that point in time. Because in order to be a zava, you need to be a nida first. To be a nida first, you have 7 days of tuma. Then you have your yamei ziva, the 11 days of yamei ziva. You need 3 days in sequence then where you see damim in order to become a zavak dola. So at minimum, in order to become a Zavak Dola, you would need 10 days, 7 days of Nida, then 3 days of Ziva, and that's why in Isha Bat Yudyomim Liziva. Minani Milay, how do we know this? The Tanra Banan, Isha. Once again, the Parsha of Zava begins with the word Isha. Isha, ki azuv zov doma yarmim ravim, below 8 Nidata, o ki tazuv al Nidata, ko yimei zov tumata, ki mei Nidata, tiye tmeya hi. So Isha, again, implies a woman of age. En li ela Isha, bat yud yomim leziva minayin, tamalomar, ve Isha. Again, the extra vav is a reboy to include a woman that's even below the age of bat mitzvah. Again, we saw both of these gemaras earlier back on Lamed Bet. Tinok ben yom echad. This is the next part of the mission that speaks about boys. How do we know that a tinok ben yom echad has a din of ziva? If he has a zavi mission, he would be tamei, the turn of banan. The pasuk begins by the parshia of Zav. Dabru al b'nei Zav, amar talehem, ish ish, ki ezav mi psaro, zovo tamei hu. And the Gemara says, ish ish, matam lomar ish ish. What's the duplication of ish doing here? Rabot ben yom echad, shemitamei b'ziva, divrei Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says the duplication of ish ish makes it that we include not only just an ish, a man of age, but we include even a minor, even someone below that age. Whether that's because it's ein miut acha miut el rabot, ish is mimayet, and then you have the same miut again, so two miutim end up being a ribui, or simply the extraneous language of ish is what Rabbi Yehuda is focused on. Rabbi Shmuel ben Osher of Yochanan ben Broko omer, ein utzarich, you don't need to learn it from there. Hari omer, the last pasuk found in the parshia of the tumot at the end of Mitzvah says, v'davah v'nidata, v'zav etzovo, lazachar v'la nikeva, and he says the word zachar nekeva then indicate to you the following, the zachar koshu ben gadol ben katan. It's one thing to speak about an ish, that means someone of age. Zachar is much more generic, it just means male, that can mean any age, that means a minor or someone of age. The nekeva also in this summary uses the word nekeva instead of isha, koshi ben gadola ben katana, whether she is of age or not. So he learns all of this from that final pasuk. In vain, matam alomar ish ish. What does he do with the extraneous ish ish? Gemara also discusses the vavs of the isha. Gemara back on Lamed Bet, we discuss more extensively the different views or different opinions. Here the Gemara is just bringing the highlights. Dibra Torah, Kleshom Bnei Adam. According to Rabbi Shmuel ben Osher, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, ish ish is just a literary style. It's the way that the Torah speaks. There's nothing significant in the duplication of the word ish. And he learns out minors, or as children, from the Zachar Nekeva, which is a more generic term than Ish Ve'isha. And now the Gemara moves on to Umei Tamei Min Negayim. We said in the Mishnah that even a day-old child can't become Tamei B'Tumat Negayim B'Tzarat. Dichtiv, Because the pasuk says, Adam kiyeh be'or b'saro. So again, he uses the term Adam, which is Adam kosho. Adam is a generic term for any human being, for anyone, and that can imply independent of age, independent of gender. And as Tosafot pointed out yesterday, Tumat Nigaim, it says, Ish o Isha. The Parshia opens up with Ish o Isha. So then you would have thought that that demands of age in order to be Tamei Tumat Nigaim. Using the word Adam then changes, like Zachar Nekeva, it's a much more generic term, and therefore it does not require Ish o Isha. Umitamei v'tamei meit, dichtiv. So here, again, Tamei meit, you might have thought otherwise, because Tosafot says over here, because it says, Ish asher yitma below yitchata by Parshat Chukat. It says the person who becomes Tamei Meit, it doesn't cleanse themselves. There it uses the term Ish. So maybe you would have thought that Ish is required and only to have Tamei Meit. So then we have Dichtiv al Nafshot asher yusham. There in Bamidbar Yutet, Tumat Tameit, it says al Nafshot asher yusham. It uses a generic term of Nafshot instead of Ish or Isha. And therefore Nefesh is Kodhu. Any living being, any living individual will be subject to the din of Tumat Hamet. So in all these cases, we're dispelling what you might have thought because of Ish O Isha, and we're saying instead of it being Ish O Isha, there's some sort of term that speaks more generically, whether it's a Ish Ish, it's a Vav that's added, or over here where the language itself, where you use Adam, or you use Nefesh, which are much more generic terms, that indicates to us that they have application beyond simply Ish V'Isha. Zokek Liyubum. So we said in the Mishnah that if he's a day old, then he requires his brother's wife to have Yibum. Obviously, she's going to have to wait now because he's so young, and he can't perform Yibum or Chalitza at this point in time, so she'll have to wait for him. But how do we know that once he is a day old, that he requires her to have Yibum performed or Chalitza performed? Dichtiv, because in Parshiat Yibum it says, Ke yeshvu achim yachdav, that when brothers live together in the same time period, achim shayu lahem yeshiva achat ba'olam. We learn from that they have to be together in the world. Now, that has two ramifications. One ramification is if he's born after his brother passes away, then there's no din of Yibum, and he's precluded from that Parshiat because they were not yeshvu yachim yachdav. On the other hand, it says here that they just need to be together in the world. There's no time period. So even the smallest amount of time, he's born before his brother is deceased, then that makes him Yeshua Yachim Yachdav, and he subjects him to the Parshia of Yibum. And that's why, as long as there's overlap between them, as long as the baby is born before the brother passes away, then they are Yeshua Yachim Yachdav, and they're subject to Yibum. Upoter mina Yibum. He also exempts the mother from having to perform Yibum. Because it says, Uvein ein lo, Amar Rachmana. The Torah says that if he doesn't have a child, then she is chayevet in Yibum. Here, yesh lo ben, vayitlei. He has a child, he has an offspring, it doesn't have to be a boy necessarily, as we noted in the Mishnah yesterday, that even though in the latter part of the Mishnah it only speaks about a tinok, ben yom echad, still it has application both to tinok and tinoket, because certain of the dinim there have cross-application. Some of them are uniquely associated with the male, and that's why the Mishnah just used a boy in order to make it clear across the board. But things like Yibum, if you have a daughter, then that's also puter, the Isha, from having to perform Yibum there. Here, the word ben does not necessarily mean a son, it means offspring. And we learned that from the ben ein lo, and the Gemara tells us that ein lo is ayin lo. Take a look, investigate to make sure that there is no offspring. And therefore, even children, grandchildren, can exempt the woman from having to perform Yibum. And he is able to cause his mother to partake in Truma. The mother, who is a Bat Yisrael, who's married to a Kohen, had the privilege of eating Truma because she was married to a Kohen. If he passes away, she loses that privilege. The only way that privilege remains with her is if she has a child. And that's what it says here, Umachil Bitruma. That if he's a day old, he permits her, he gives her the right to continue to eat Bitruma Dichtiv. V'yilid beito heim yochlu bilachmo. And it says about the Kohen, those that are born into his household will partake of the lechem, will partake of the truma. And the word yochlu, they read as karibe ya'achilu bilachmo. Not only yochlu will they eat, but rather they will cause to eat. That they will then, facilitate the ability of the mother to eat truma or continue to eat truma. So all you need is a yelid bayit. You need someone who's born. As long as there is a born child, then even a day-old child can grant the mother the permission or the ability to continue to eat truma like she did while her husband was alive. Right? Uposel min truma. You also can render the mother unable to eat truma. This is in a case where a bat kohen marries a Yisrael. As long as she's married to the Yisrael, she's no longer allowed or permitted to partake in the truma of her father's house. If her husband passes away, then she returns to her father's house. It says, v'shava el beit avia kinu rea. She goes back to her father's house like when she was a youngster. That is only true as long as she does not have offspring. She doesn't have children. If she has children, then she remains outside of the father's house and she cannot partake in the truma. So that's what it says here. Posel min ha-truma. She has a child, then it renders her invalid for returning to her father's house and partaking in the truma. It says, uvat kohen, tiel ish zar, he, b'trumat ha-kodashim, lo tochel. She loses her right to truma when she marries Israel, or Levi. Uvat kohen, ki tiel almana u'grusha, if she somehow has terminated from that marriage, whether it's through death or through divorce. Vizera ein la, and she has no offspring. Shava el beit avia ki ne'ureha. She'll go back like her young years to her father's house. Milechem avia tochel. She can now once again partake in the lechem of her father, meaning the truma. V'chozar lo yochal bo. Here the Gemara quotes that as the source. It says, v'zera in la amar rachmana va'itlo. It says that she can't have any offspring, then now she has offspring once the baby is born. Mar says, ma'iria zera afilu ubar nami. Wait a minute. Why does the baby have to be born in order for it to disqualify her from going back to her father's house? Even if it's in utero, even if it's a fetus, it disqualifies her. Dichtiv kin ni'ureha. She returns to her father's house like when she was a young girl. Prat limi'uberet. If she's pregnant, she doesn't look like the way she did when she left her father's house. She's no longer kin ni'ureha. So that disqualifies her. Tzriche, we need both exclusions. Had the Torah just written that she has no offspring, mishum demeikara chad gufa, v'ashto tre gufe. I would have thought the reason that she's disqualified from returning to her father's house is she started out as a single person, and now she is two people. Because she has a child, she has an offspring, and that's the disqualifying factor. Aval halcha demeikara chad gufa, v'ashto chad gufa, if it was solely for that pasuk of Zerein La, I would have thought when she's pregnant, she can still go back to her father's house. She was one person when she left, and she's one person when she came back. She might be a little bigger, but she's still one person. Therefore, I would have thought maybe it would be okay. That's why, Kotav Rachmana, ki ni'ureha. She has to be like when she was a youngster. Bikotav Rachmana, ki ni'ureha. Had it only written ki ni'ureha, like when she was young, mishum demi kara gufa srika. When she left her father's house, she was an empty body. V'ashto gufa malyo. And now her body is full. Meaning that there's a change physically in the woman. She was single, young, not pregnant. Now she's a little older, she's pregnant, and there's a significant physical difference in the woman. So maybe that's not called kinura. But here, aval hocha, in a case where she already had the child, demi kara gufa srika, originally she was not pregnant, she was just an empty woman. Vashta gufa srika, and now she continues to be an empty woman. She's already discharged. She's already given birth to the baby. Ema techo. Maybe she should be able to partake in the truma. Sricha, that's why I also need the pasuk of vezera ein la. To teach you that there's a disqualifying factor both in being pregnant and in having offspring. Both of those disqualify her from coming back to eat truma in her father's house. Mar says, cry atarutz. You did a great job. You solved the stira in the psukim as to why you need ni'ureha and why you need zera ein la. Ela matnitan ma'iria yom echad. Our Mishnah still doesn't make so much sense. Why did our Mishnah mention a child that's one day old, afilu ubar nami? In truth, even a pregnant woman, a woman with a fetus, would also be restricted from returning to her father's house and partaking in the truma. So why does our Mishnah pick Yom Echad, if it's a threshold, the threshold's much earlier. If she's pregnant, that's already the threshold that disqualifies her. I understand why you have to differentiate between Zera and La and Ura because of the Psukim, but in the Mishnah, it's coming to tell you the Halacha. The Halacha is that once she's pregnant, she is disqualified. So I'm Rav Sheshet. Sheshet says, Hacha b'may eskinan. What are we dealing with here? B'kohen shesh lo shtei nashim. He has two wives. One illicit. One, that's fine. Achat grusha. He married a divorcee, which is a problematic marriage. The offspring from that marriage will be chalalin, that are not kohanim. They will lose all status as a kohen. They will michulal. They'll be profane. And then v'achat sheinu grusha. He also happens to have a wife that is fine for him to marry. No issues with her. V'yesh lo banim misheinu grusha. And he has children from the wife that is permissible for him to be married to. So he has children that are kohanim, full-fledged kohanim. V'yesh lo ben yom echad min ha-grusha. And now he has one child from the woman who is a divorcee that he married, which was improper. And that child that is born is a chalal. That child then is posel ba'avdei aviv melechol b'truma. He causes problems for the servants of his father's house to partake in the truma. Ula fuke nidrabi yosi. And this position of our Mishnah comes to negate the position of Rabbi Yossi, Damar Ubar Nami Posel, who says that an Ubar also has the capacity to be Posel. Mashmalan, our Mishnah comes to teach us, Ben Yom Echad in Ubar Lo. Only a day-old child has that capacity, not an Ubar. Let's start out with the case. Rashi says that the case here is a case where he's married to a Grusha in a Grusha, and again, he has children from the Enu Grusha, full-fledged Kohanim. When you have an Eved Kanani that is a part of the household, then if the father's alive, they are his Avadim, and the Avadim eat because they're Kinyan Kaspo. They're his possession, and therefore they can partake in the Truma. When the father's deceased, then his children, who are Kohanim, inherit him. And then because of those children Kohanim, the Avadim can continue to eat Truma because they are now the possession of Kohanim, who are the children of the father. The problem over here is that we have another child who is not a Kohen. That child is a Chalal because he's born to a woman who was illegal, illicit for him to marry. And the child that is produced from that marriage is disqualified. Now, as far as Yerusha is concerned, as far as inheritance is concerned, he is an equal partner to all the other brothers. He is a son of the father. And all the brothers through the father share in the Yerusha. So he is now a partner in the Yerusha. His partnership in the Yerusha actually causes a problem. Because had he been the only child, and then he had inherited the Avadim, then the Avadim would have no permission to eat Truma. He doesn't have a right to eat Truma. So obviously his possessions, his Avadim, would not have the right to Truma. Over here, he's one of a number of children. But the problem is, we don't know how the estate is going to get divided. And so we look at it as if he has a partial ownership in every aspect of the estate. So if there were two children that were Kohanim and this child, then we basically divide every asset into thirds, and he owns one third of every asset, including the Avadim. And therefore he disqualifies the Avadim from partaking in Truma. And that is Dafka Yom Echad. It's only a day-old child that does that because he's Ra'oi Yerusha. He can inherit. He's alive and he can inherit. Therefore, he disqualifies the Avadim. As opposed to if he was an Ubar, then he doesn't have any rights. As an Ubar, he doesn't have any Kinyanim. He doesn't have any ownership rights. And therefore, the Avadim can continue to eat in the Truma until the baby is born. That is the view of our Mishnah, as opposed to Rabbi Yossi, whereby Rabbi Yossi, who says in Yivamot, that an Ubar has those Chia. He has the right of ownership. He has the right to Kinyanim, and given that, he now owns a portion of these Avadim, and therefore, even in utero, he causes problem for the Avadim. So Rashi says it's a fundamental machloket here between our Mishnah, or what maybe you call the Chachamim, and Rabbi Yossi. The one question on the table is a Ubar able to take possession of an asset? According to Rabbi Yossi, the answer is yes, and therefore, he disqualifies the Avadim from eating Truma, even in utero. Whereas for the Chachamim, the answer is no. And therefore, he only disqualifies the Avadim after he's born. And that's what our Mishnah is speaking about. It's speaking about a situation or a scenario in which it was Yom Echad. And that's why he disqualifies the Abadim from partaking in Truma. That is what it means, Pusel mina Truma. Because here he's only Pusel once he's born, not before he's born. Tosafot and many other Rishonim disagree with Rashi. And they believe that the Machloket between Rabbi Yossi and the Chachamim isn't as fundamental as Rashi makes it out to be. Where Rashi says they're arguing in whether an Ubar has rights of ownership or can be Zocheh, that he can have a kinyan. Tosafot and the other Rishonim believe that both the Chachamim and Rabbi Yossi believe that an Ubar has a right of ownership and a right of Zchiyah. The only question is, what is the status of the Ubar? The Ubar is only problematic for the Avadim if he is a male that is born. If he is a viable entity that is male, will he cause a problem for the Avadim? If he is not a viable entity, then obviously he doesn't cause a problem because he's not going to inherit. If he is a daughter, he also will not cause a problem because she will not inherit. So the only case where it's a problem is if it's a male that is born from this pregnancy. And so what Tosafot points out is that the machloket here is not whether the Ubar can be Zocheh or not Zocheh. Everybody believes the Ubar is Zocheh. The question is, do we worry about this Ubar? Rabbi Yossi says there is a good chance that this is a male offspring. And given that, we have to tell the Abadim to suspend they're eating up Truma until we have certainty about the birth of this Ubar. On the other hand, the Chachamim say, let's look at the probabilities. You have a 50-50 probability as to being a male or a female, so that's even probabilities. If that was the case, it would be a Safek and we would say a Sur. But then you have to add into that the minority of fetuses that don't make it to full term, that do not survive, are not viable. So I have here a majority of entities that are viable, a minority that are not viable. Then even within the majority, 50% of them are male, 50% of them are female. That means the majority of pregnancies will not end up creating an item that is problematic for these avadim. Because you start out with 50% female, you're already at 50%. Then there's also this small percentage of fetuses that don't make it, that are not viable. So if I add together the minority of fetuses that are not viable, plus the 50% of females, I'm way over 50%. I'm 55, 60, whatever the number is, percentage that are not going to cause problems for the Abadim. So I basically go after the rove. In this case, if it's a fake, I use the rove, and the rove tells me that this is not going to be an entity that causes a problem for the Abadim. So despite the fact that an entity in utero can have a zchiyah according to the Chachamim, nevertheless, in this scenario, we won't grant them that zchiyah. We won't worry about that zchiyah because al harov, he won't be problematic or she won't be problematic. It's an entity that will not cause a problem for the avadim. That's a machloket here in the Rishonim as to how to explain this position of Rav Sheshet in explaining the machloket between the Chachamim and Rav Yossi as to whether it has to do with the fundamental question as to whether Ubar is zocher or not. That's Rashi's view. Or like Tosafot, who says that the Machloket is not about Ubar Zocheh, that we agree on. The question is, how do we view this entity in utero? Do we consider them to be a problem? Or we just follow the robe and say that we're not going to worry about it until it's born? And our Mishnah is the position of the Chachamim, or those that dissent on Rabbi Yossi. According to Rashi, it means that they believe in Ubar is not Zocheh. Or according to Tosafot, it means that even though the Ubar is Zocheh, we're not going to worry about it because a la rove, a pregnancy is not going to produce an entity that is problematic for the Avadim. Nochel umanchil. So he inherits and he can grant inheritance. Nochel miman. Who does he inherit from? Mi'aviv, from his father. Umanchil the man. And who does he grant inheritance to? Le'achav mi'aviv, from his brothers through his father. Yerusha is only through the father's side. There is no Yerusha pass through the mother's side. And that is because it's the Mishpachotam, the Beit Avotam. Mishpachat Av, Nikra Mishpacha. The father's Mishpacha is called Mishpacha, and the mother's Mishpacha is not. And therefore, in general, Yerusha is only governed by father or patrilineal connection. And so brothers who are common through a father, they will share in Yerusha. And if one of the brothers passes away, then the father first would inherit, but the father is deceased already, then the brothers will share in the Yerusha from that brother. So over here, you have a child who inherits from his father. If he's born, he's one day old, he's like any one of the other brothers, and he will inherit from his father. Again, if he passes away, then the brothers through the father will inherit him. And the Gemara says about this, what's the Chiddush over here? Why does it matter that he's born or he's not born? Because Ibai me'avua liarte, Ibai mine liarte. The other brothers are indifferent as to whether they inherit from their father or they inherit from him. Say the baby had not been born and there were three brothers. So those three brothers each inherit 1/3 of the estate because their father passed away, absent this baby that is born. Let's say the baby is born. Well, if the baby's born, then they divide it up into fours, and each one of them gets a quarter of the estate. Then this baby passes away and passes them the Yerusha. Well, you take that baby's quarter of the estate, you divide that up into thirds and give it to the other three brothers. They'll end up, each one of them, with 1/3 of the estate. If that's the case, what does it matter that there's a baby one day old that passes away versus if there's no baby at all? What's the chiddush of the Mishnah that he's nochel u'manchil if he is one day old? There's no difference to whether he is born or not born. The brothers end up with the same amount of Yerusha. So that Gemara says, Rav Sheshet explains, Amar Rav Sheshet, nochel b'nichseyayim manchil le'achav minahav. He inherits his mother's property to pass that to the brothers through the father. So there is an exception to the rule in terms of inheritance, which is that a mother whose husband is not alive, so the husband is the primary or the first inheritor of the mother, of the woman. Absent the husband, then if she has children, then those children are the inheritors of her estate or her assets or property. So the husband is the first line. There is something midrabanan called ketubat benin dichrin, which says that even though the husband inherits his wife, mina Torah, according to most, then after he passes away, the children of that woman get advantage in the Yerusha, and her ketubah will go to them directly, not to all of the children. The reason they did that, midrabanan, is because otherwise parents, fathers, would not give dowries to their daughters, knowing that that would be split between many children that have nothing to do with them. If an individual had 2-3 wives, he could have children from other women, and all of a sudden those children from other women are going to be inheritors of this father who granted a dowry to his daughter. So in order to prevent that reluctance to give to the daughter, the Chachamim instituted what's called ketubat benin dichrin, which is that if a husband marries multiple wives, then the ketubah of each wife belongs to the children of that wife. As long as there's some residual to split between them, midoraita, then the ketubah will go first to the children of that particular woman, and that way you protect the assets that are given as a dowry from going to other families or other women's children, and they stay within the children of this woman. But then if the husband predeceases his wife, and then the woman keeps her assets or is a possessor of her assets, those assets, when she passes away, will pass to her offspring, to her children. If she has no children, then the assets will return to her family. So in this instance, the child makes a big difference. If there is a child in the world, he will inherit his mother's estate. If he inherits his mother's estate and passes away, then the entitled parties to his estate are his brothers through the father. So this is assets or possessions that the brothers would have no access to. They have no access to because this is a woman who's not related to them. It is another wife of their father, but it's not their mother. And they would not inherit her. Had it not been for this child, the assets would go back to the woman's family. Now that there's a child, that child inherits his mother. And when he inherits his mother and then passes away, those assets go to his brothers through the father. So the brothers through the father now are beneficiaries of his being born or being alive when his mother passed away. And so that's what it means over here, that a ben inherits his mother, but not vice versa. The mother does not inherit the child, and therefore the kroveiim are not going to inherit or take over his possession. So if he passed away, the assets will stay with the brothers. It will not go to the mother's family, but she predeceases him, then he is the inheritor of his mother's possessions. That's only true if he's alive. So as long as he's alive, he gets an inheritance. He cannot inherit his mother while he's in utero in order to then give those possessions to his brothers. V'davka ben yom echad, that's only if he is a day old, so that he actually is born. Aval ubar, lo. But if he's in utero, that will not be the case. My time up. Why can't the ubar successfully inherit his mother. So we just said before, at least according to Rabbi Yossi, an Ubar has a Chia. And according to many Rishonim, even the Chachamim agree with that, that an Ubar has a Chia. So why can't he inherit his mother in utero? Because to who might Beresha? Because he always dies first. Ve'ein aben Yoresha Timo, but Keper. And a child cannot inherit his mother when he's already passed away, meaning when he's already in the grave. In order to give that possession to his brothers that come through a common father. So here the Gemara suggests, which it happens to be true, that is, if a woman passes away, the fetus or the baby that's inside of her will pass away first. And that's because the woman is the provider of whatever nutrition sustenance the baby needs. And the woman's body will give up of her nutrition to the baby up to a point. But once it already puts her into danger, then the woman's body will shut down the sustenance or provisions that it's giving to the baby in order to preserve itself before it would lose out and die. So the woman who's going to die, of course, the other parts or the vitals will shut down. One of those vitals is the baby. So if the woman is going to die, then the baby will die first. And therefore, anytime the baby's in utero, he will not inherit his mother because he will predecease his mother. That's the underlying assumption here in the Gemara, and that's why you needed the baby to be born. Where it says, Ini, is that really true? That the baby always predeceases his mother. Bahava Ubda, we had a case where a mother passed away, and there was a baby in utero. Upirkas Adlat Pirkuse, and even after the mother passed away, the baby was still kicking or moving inside of the mother. Amar Mar Breid Ravashi, so we have Mar Breid Ravashi telling us, Midahava Zanav Halita'a. It's no different than the tail of a lizard that still moves after it's cut off from the lizard. Nobody's going to say after you cut off the tail from the lizard that the tail is alive. But the tail keeps moving. That's because electric impulses that were sent from the lizard to the tail were sent before it was cut off. And therefore it continues to move even after it was cut off. And there it happens to be that it's intentional because it's a protective device for the lizard to escape. Because it deceives the enemy into thinking that they have the lizard and they just have his tail. But still, those are electric impulses that were sent before it was chopped off from the lizard. And similarly here, the baby's movement was a process that took place before it passed away. And those electric impulses are now being borne out even after the death of the fetus. No different than Sikreshe, where you cut off the head of the chicken's still running around. All those cases where we have movement of the animal, even after the animal's clearly dead because you severed the head, despite that, there still is movement, but that movement is not an indication of life. And that's what he's saying over here, that movement was not an indication of life. All right, so Tosafot over here raises a number of issues, which are that we have evidence to the contrary, that we find many places in Shas that the fetus is able to survive even after the death of the mother. The question is, how can you make a suggestion or a definitive statement that the baby always dies? We have a Gemara in Arachin, which we discussed on Daf Zayin, or a case where a Shechta mother, and then you have a Ben Pakua, then you have a baby that's inside, and the Shechita of the mother is Mitaher, the baby that's inside. We also had that in the Kulin. How could that be? If you're Shechting the mother, and the mother's dead, then how is it that there's a fetus that is surviving inside of the mother, if the fetus always dies before the mother? Then how do you have every case of a ben pakua when you shech the mother and then there's a baby inside that is walking viable entities? That's number one. Number two is, we also require, when a woman is subject to a death penalty and she's pregnant, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that we intentionally cause her to abort the baby before she's put to death because we don't want to have to deal with the problem of the baby after she is put to death. So we force the aborting of the baby, which would have happened anyway, but we do it beforehand, implying that had we waited till afterwards, there's a possibility that she could be put to death and the baby would survive, or the baby would still be a viable entity. So in order to prevent that, we cause the aborting of the baby beforehand. All of these issues or situations seem to indicate that there is a possibility of the entity or the fetus surviving, even though the mother's passed away. The last one is the Mishnah in Olot, which is very pivotal in this issue. We which is that when a baby's being born, whose life do we take to protect the other party's life? So when the baby's internal to the mother, then the baby's classified as a rodef, and the mother's life takes precedence, and therefore we would then kill the baby to protect the life of the mother, whether it means to pull the baby out, to cut the baby out, whatever we have to do to save the mother. Once the baby's head emerges from the mother, or begins to emerge from the mother, then we do not say that anymore. Then, for whatever reasons, which we're not going to discuss right now, either they both become rodfim then, or the way that the Rambam says it's tivosha lolam, at that point, even if the baby is causing the mother the possibility of dying, then we no longer take the life of the baby to protect the mother. So over there, you have a possibility that the mother is dying in childbirth and will die in childbirth, and yet the baby will still be born. So all of these cases seem to indicate otherwise, that you can't have a baby survive the death of the mother. Tosafot makes a very simple chiluk, which seems pretty obvious, and that chiluk can explain all of these cases. And that is, yesh chiluk, ben meita, ben neherga. There's a big difference between dying and being killed. When a woman dies, that is because there's a weakening of the body and a shutting down of the systems. Again, the woman's body will shut down the baby before it shuts herself down in order to protect herself. It's self-preservation. In the case where the woman dies of natural death, then the baby will not survive the mother because the mother will not give sustenance to the baby before it gives sustenance to herself. And therefore, the baby always dies before the mother. In a case where the mother is killed, in that situation, the mother was perfectly healthy until the moment before she was killed. Therefore, the baby was getting full sustenance. When you kill the mother, that doesn't mean that the baby has to die before the mother did. It was sudden trauma to the mother. That sudden trauma to the mother doesn't mean the baby has to die first. And in all those cases, like when you shech the mother, the reason that the fetus is still alive afterwards is because exactly that. The mother was a full, healthy behemah until that point in time. When you shecht it, all you did was create a sudden change in her status. The baby doesn't have to be affected by that sudden change. It's too sudden for the mother's systems to shut down the baby to cause the survival of the mother. The mother's not going to survive anyway. So all these cases, Tosafot points out, there's a difference between nerga and mita. So that's one very important factor here, because that has implications for the determination of death of individuals, as well as the ability to make organ donations. And that is because you need to determine when the point of death is. If you determine what death is by brainstem death, then there's a possibility of harvesting organs from individuals. If you think that you need cessation of the respiratory side of the individual, then there's no way to harvest most of the organs because of the fact that most of the organs then will be dead by the time you get to them, because you're taking them out after respiration, after circulation's already been terminated, and that causes the organs to shut down before you can even transplant them. One of the key factors here is that a woman who is brain dead can give birth to a baby. And based on the Gemara's assumption here, that a woman who dies, the fetus always dies before her. Given that conclusion, then if a woman who's brain dead can give birth to a baby, that shows you that the woman must be alive according to the logic of the Gemara. Had it been that the mother was already dead, then the baby would not survive her. And so therefore, brain death must not be the termination of life for an individual. That is one of the major proofs of those individuals who believe that brainstem death is not classified as death. It's the fact that a woman can give birth even after she is brain dead. When this issue came before the Knesset and they were putting the laws into effect in Israel, as the criterion for death in order to prevent problems with doctors declaring people dead in order to get or harvest their organs. So they go by what's called the Harvard criteria. In Israel, actually, they have a higher standard than the Harvard criteria. They use all of the criterion, and therefore, it's a very high standard in terms of determining death. It was a law that was going to pass through the Knesset, and they needed to make decisions with regards to this law in terms of determining brain death. And they went to Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach to discuss it. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach discussed the Gemara in Arachin, our Gemara here, and said that it can't be. If brainstem death is the termination of life, why is the woman giving birth? And so they told him that it's possible that you can kill an animal or a human being, and they still could give birth, irrespective of brainstem death or not brainstem death. The way to do that is, for instance, when you shecht an animal. And you shecht the animal, there's no one who's going to disagree that the animal is dead once the shechita takes place, because we know that you've severed any life-preserving structure to the animal, and therefore the animal is going to die for sure. And what they wanted to show is that even an animal who was shechted can still give birth to an entity. And that shows you that there is no necessarily correlation between the woman dying and the baby having to die, or absolutely having to die, before the mother. And so Rav Shlomo Zalman asked them to put that experiment together. It's very hard to do because you have to get permission from the authorities with regards to the animals and to do the whole experiment. They did such an experiment where they had to get a pregnant sheep. They shechted the mother and they put the mother onto a quote unquote respirator circulatory system, kept the vitals of the mother alive and gave birth to the baby that was inside the mother even after her head was severed. What you show there is that even though the mother is clearly dead, that the fetus can survive even though the mother is dead. And that shows, or they wanted to show through that, that the fact that you can give birth is not a determination that you're not dead. Because here they had an animal that was clearly dead and was still able to give birth. So then Rav Shlomo Zalman came up with a higher level of criteria, but he moved to the side that maybe brainstem death is considered to be death, but he has a higher standard than the standards that were passed in the law. But still, his criterion are not like those that believe that it's respiratory or circulatory death, but that it is actually brainstem death. But he requires a very high level of brainstem death or testing to know for certain that there is brainstem death. And that's connected to our sugya over here. And then they have to discuss what the logic is. So now the Gemara says, Mar b'rei d'Rav Yosef, mishpei d'Rav Amar, Lomar shememait bechalekat bechora. That the reason that he has to be a day old is to teach you that he has impact on the portion of the bechor. That is that if you have a bechor has a right to a double portion in the inheritance. This baby will skew or change the dynamic of the bechor's inheritance. So that's why it makes a difference. While he's in utero, he has no impact on the bechor. We'll see that in a second. But once he is born, he has an impact on the bechor. Let us say that we have a situation in which you have a bechor and you have a pashut. You have a firstborn and you have a regular child. In that situation, if the Yerusha is comprised of 6 units, then they divide up the estate into 3. You have 2 units for each third. Then the bechor gets a double portion. So he'll get 4 zuhuvim out of the 6 zuhuvim, which is 2/3 of the estate. And the pashut gets 2 zuhuvim out of the 6, which is 1/3 of the estate. That would be the division. If you enter a third child into the picture, that changes the dynamic. If you have now 3 children dividing the estate of 6, now you have to divide the estate into 4. That is, 1.5 times 4 is 6. So now if I distribute this evenly between the children, that means that each of them will get a portion of 1.5, plus the bechor will get an additional 1.5. So the bechor will get 3 portions, whereas the other 2 will get 1.5. So out of the estate, the bechor gets 3/6 of the estate, or half the estate, as opposed to what he got when there was only 1 brother, where he got 2/3 of the estate. And over here, the individuals will get 1.5 each, instead of getting 2 that the pashut would have gotten had there only been 2 brothers. So the birth of the tinok changes what the bechor is entitled to. Had it not been for the tinok, then the bechor would have gotten 2/3 of the estate. Now that this baby is born, he only gets 1/2 of the estate. Okay, that's true not only of the bechor, that's also true of the other brother as well. Any brother that's there is going to get less when you have another brother that causes the division of the estate. This is what we're going to speak about now, is that that only is true if the baby is born before the father passes away, and then the father passes away. This is the dynamic that will take place. We're going to mix it up in a second and speak about other scenarios where it has impact. Mar b'rei d'Rav Yosef mishmei d'Rava. So now we have another statement. First statement was from Mar b'rei d'Rav Yosef mishmei d'Rava that a baby affects the Yerusha of the Bechor, which of course it does. It affects the Yerusha of all the brothers when he's born. And so that's one impact. But he also mentions here, ben shenolad, achar mitatav, the child that's born after the father is deceased, einu memaet b'chelek ha-bechora. He does not diminish the portion of the bechor when he's born after the father has passed away. My daimo, what's the reason? Because it says, v'yaldulo, Be'inan. It has to mean that he is born in order to diminish the portion of the Bechorah. The father deceased, father passed away, the Bechor is going to get his portion irrespective of the other child that's going to be born. Then once that child is born, they have to divide up the remainder of the estate. So in a case where you have a son that's born after the Mitat Av, then before that son was born, you only had two brothers, the Bechor and the Pashut. Again, when we divided that up, you took the six units, the six Zehuvim of the estate, and you divided into thirds, and each one was a two Zehuvim per unit. The Bechor got two of those units, the Pashut got one of those units. So the Bechor got four Zehuvim, and the Pashut got two Zehuvim. Now in this scenario, we're going to do the same thing, because the baby is yet to be born. So as far as the extra portion that the Bechor is going to get, he's going to get two Zehuvim, because that's his extra portion. But now that the baby is born, that baby has an entitlement to the remainder of the estate. So after the four parts of the estate that are left over, they're going to divide into thirds between them. So you're going to take those four, and each one of them is going to get one and a third of the estate. And that means that the Bechor overall will get three and a third of the estate. He'll get the two, which are his chilek and the Bechorah, which are not impacted by this baby that's in utero, and he will get a third of the remainder of the estate, which he will divide with his baby once it's born. So he'll get one and a third plus two, which is three and a third. And the other two, the Pashut plus the Ubar, who's born, each will get one and a third. So here you have an impact between whether the Ubar is born or not born. If the baby is born as Yom Echad, he diminishes the Bechor's portion in the double portion. Whereas if he's still in utero, he doesn't have any impact on the Bechor's portion. He has an impact on the division of the estate, on the remainder of the estate. But the portion of the Bechor is not impacted by him. So it'll make a difference between, if he's born before the father is deceased, the Bechor only gets three of the estate, or half of the estate. If he is born after the father has already passed away, then the Bechor gets three and a third. He actually gets more, because the Ubar does not diminish his extra portion. He only diminishes his regular portion in the Bechorah. So there's a big nafkamina between whether he's Yom Echad or he's an Ubar, and that's what Mar Beret of Yosef is saying, named the Rava, that he's Mamait Bechelik of Bechorah. He has impact on the Chelik of the Bechorah if he's already born. If he's in utero, he doesn't have that impact. And then, if this baby, whether he was born before the father passed away, or he was born after the father passed away, and whether or not he had impact on the Bechorah is determined by that. If he passes away, then he passes his possession to the two surviving brothers, which is the Bechor and the Pashut. So in a case where he was born before the father passed away, and he caused a diminishment in the Bechor's portion, whereby the Bechor only got half the estate, and the other two brothers got each a quarter of the estate, meaning that the Bechor got three Zuzim, and they each got one and a half Zuzim. In that case, if the young baby dies, that one and a half is then divided between the Bechor and the Pashut. Each one of them will get three quarters of a Zehuv. And that means that in total, the Bechor would get three and three quarters of Zehuvim, whereas the Pashut would get two and a quarter of the Zehuvim. So here there is a nafkamina that the baby was born and then passed away, because when he's born, he diminishes the Bechor's right in the Chelek HaBechorah. That means that if he passes away then, the resultant division between the Bechor and Pashut will be more favorable towards the Pashut, and the Bechor and Pashut will not end up like they did before. The Bechor will not get two-thirds of the estate and the Pashut one-third of the estate. Rather, the Bechor will get three and three-quarters of the six Zuzuvim, rather than the four he would have gotten had the baby never been born. And the Pashut will get two and a quarter, rather than the two had he not been born. On the other hand, if the baby was in utero when his father passed away, and he has no impact on the Chelek HaBechorah, and as we said, the Bechor gets three and a third, and the Pashut and the Ubar get one and a third each, then if the Ubar passes away, then that one and one third of the Ubar is now divided by the Bechor and Pashut. Each one of them will get two-thirds of a Zehuv. If you add that to the three and a third that the Bechor already has, he now ends up with four-sixths of the Zehuvim. And if you add that two-thirds to the one and a third that the Pashut got, he gets two out of the six Zehuvim. Or in essence, you're back to what would have happened as if the baby had never been born. So if you have an Ubar that is born after the father has passed away, then he doesn't affect the Bechor, and if he passes away, the division between the Bechor and the Pashut will end up exactly as if the baby never existed. And that means that the Bechor will get 4/6 or 2/3, and the Pashut will get 2/6 or 1/3, as opposed to the case where the baby's born before the father passes away, where his impact on the Chelek HaBechorah, and then if he passes away after that, the Bechor will end up with less and the Pashut with more, because the Chelek HaBechor has been diminished by the birth of this Tinok. The Gemara says, Surah Matnuhachi. That's the memorot that they brought in Surah. The Pumpudita, in the Beit Midrash, in the Shiva and Pumpudita, this is what they had the memorot to be. Amar Mar Bereid the Rabbi Yosef, Mishmei the Rava. Bechor, Shinolochilad, Achar Mitat Aviv. If the Bechor is born after his father passed away, Enotel Bishnaim. He doesn't get a double portion. My Taima, the Pasuk says, Yakir Lo, Letet Lo Bishnaim. He has to recognize him. He has to have seen him. You don't have that here because the father predeceased the Bechor. And the law is like all three of these memorot from Mar Berei Rav Yosef Mishmei Derova. That means that it will be impactful if the baby is born on the Bechorah. If it's not born, it will not be impactful. And Rashi points out here, how do you have a Bechor that is born after the father has already passed away? That doesn't make sense. If he's born after the father has passed away, he's the only child. Because he's born after the father passed away. If he was born before, that means he was a Bechor before his father passed away. So Rashi says the only scenario you can have this is, Vaisha me'uberet te'umim. If the mother is having twins. So the first one out is the Bechor. The second one out is a Pashut. So in that case, the Bechor will not get his portion. He will not be a Bechor because he was born after his father's death. But he is also a Bechor because there were two children that are born. Or, Rashi says, Inami, Sheniach bet nashim u'barot. He left two wives that were pregnant when he passed away. So in that case also, the first one that's born is the Bechor, the second one that's born is the Pashut. But neither of them could have been born before the father deceased, because if they were, they would be the Bechor already. So Rashi just points out that that has to be the scenario over here. Alright, now the Gemara continues and says, Vargo chayav. The one who kills him, is chayav tichtiv, v'ish kiyakeh kol nefesh. A person who kills any living being, mikol makom. Nefesh means any living being, not just someone who's of age, not just someone who has reached a certain threshold. This means any living entity that's a human being, if you kill them, you are chayav mitah, you're considered to be a rotzeach. Tosafot points out, that the Gemara in Sanhedrin brings a different pasuk as the proof, and it says, Kol makeh nefesh, found in Parshat Maseh, instead of what they quote here from Parshat Emor. In both cases, they focus on the word nefesh, that killing a nefesh makes you chayav for ritzicha. So now, as all the Rishonim point out, that's only true if he's Yom Echad, if he's born. That means that the Gemara is clearly implying, and you can see that in the Bali Tosafot, he says it explicitly, that it's only a ben yom echad, a baby that's born, that is considered to be ritzicha. That means that a baby in utero is not considered to be ritzicha. That brings up, obviously, the issues of abortion, which is abortion considered to be problematic in terms of ritzicha? Because over here, the Gemara says ritzicha only applies once the baby is born. In utero, there's no din of ritzicha. So Tosfot over here already notes that difference. And says that there is no din of ritzicha for killing a baby in utero. And he says one of the most obvious proofs to that is the Torah itself in Parshat Mishpatim says that if an individual causes a woman to miscarry, he pays the mevil adot. He pays the money to the husband of this woman who lost or miscarried the baby. We don't say that he's subject to mitah, even if you call it shogeg, he still doesn't go to galut. We don't penalize him as if he killed a human being. We make them pay compensation. So that clearly shows you that you're not considered to be a rotzeach. The real question is, what is the issue, or is there an issue with aborting? So now, the Gemara in Sanhedrin already made it clear that shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam amo yishofech. Parshat Noach already says to the B'nai Noach that shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam. And the Gemara Dashin's ba'adam means even a life inside of another individual, that life is considered to be a life. And therefore, if you kill that life, you are chayav mitah, you are a rotzeach. So it's clear in the Gemara in Sanhedrin that a ben Noach that kills or aborts a fetus is considered to be a rotzeach. How does that relate to the dinim of Israel? Again, we saw in Parsha Mishpatim that it's a din of the Mabel adult, not a din of Ritzicha. So the Baalei HaTosafot in Sanhedrin say that it's a Kal V'Chomer, which means that the Gemara in a number of places notes that if it's also for a Ben Noach, it can't be Mutar Israel. They can't have it be that a Ben Noach is more stringent than Israel. That doesn't mean that they have to get the same punishment. Could be that the punishment for the Ben Noach is more severe than Israel. For instance, Geneva, Gzela, which for a Ben Noach is subject to a death penalty, for a Jew is Veshir the Gzela, Asher Gazal. So even though the punishments are different, nevertheless, the restriction against stealing is the same for a Ben Noach and Israel. And similarly, Tosafot wants to say over here, if a Ben Noach is considered to be a Rotzeach for killing a fetus, then a Ben Israel has to at least be asur in killing such a fetus. And that's what Tosafot concludes there in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, that there's an isur for a Jew to kill a fetus, even though he will not be negdar ki rotzeach. That's the view of the Baalei Tosafot. But Moshe Feinstein takes that to its ultimate form and says that that restriction is a restriction of ritzicha. It will not be called murder because there's no explicit murder that is mentioned with regards to this in the Torah for Israel. But the limud that teaches you that which is asur for a Ben Noach must be asur for Israel. Just like for the Ben Noach, it's an isur ritzicha. For the Jew as well, it'll be an isur of ritzicha. Even though it won't be absolute murder and he won't be put to death for it, it'll still be an isur that's associated with ritzicha. So Moshe says that it's very serious, and he elevates the problem to a problem of isur ritzicha, even though there will be no death penalty and the person is not classified as a rotzeach. Others, like the Ran, think that that's all midrabanan, that midoraita in Ochanami, this distinction exists between Israel and a Ben Noach, and a Ben Noach is considered a rotzeach, and Israel does not have any restriction. The Rabbanon instituted a restriction with regards to Ritzichat HaVlad. So Tosafot, first of all, qualifies this and says, Miu, Efshar Dafka Hechad Imo Chaya Lo Mechayev Arogo. Only whether his mother is alive is the murderer not considered to be a murderer until he's born. I mean, until Yetzar Rosho, until the baby is born, it's not considered to be a live entity. And that's why the halachot about the woman giving birth, you can sacrifice the baby to save the mother's life. Over there, it might even be, even if it was determined to be a live entity, he's a rodeif over there. But why is the woman not considered to be a rodeif over there? The answer is, in utero, the life is not considered to be a full-fledged life until it is born. Once the head exits and the baby is born, then they're on equal footing and you can't kill the baby to save the mother. The Tosafot says that's only true if the mother is alive, because he is dependent on the mother. Given the fact that he's dependent on the mother, he's not considered to be an independent entity. On the other hand, if the mother is deceased and the baby is still in utero, maybe over there it would be considered murder because he's no longer reliant on the mother or dependent on the mother. And Tosafot says it's no different than him being inside of a box. He's just encapsulated in something. Over here, it's no longer a live entity that he's encapsulated in, and therefore the mother is no different than a box. And just like if you killed someone inside of a box, that would be murder. So too, if you kill a baby inside of a deceased mother, then that also would be murder, because the baby has gained independence and is maybe even deemed as if born, and therefore it would be murder in that case. So then Tosafot says, even if you want to say that a baby that is in utero, even after his mother has passed away, is not considered to be like his munach bekufsa, and still would not be considered murder, then what do you do about the fact that we are mechalel at a Shabbat in order to save such a baby? If the woman passes away, the Gemara says that you can bring a sakin through Rishut Rabim to cut open the mother to save the baby that's inside. If the baby inside is not a live entity, why is it that you're allowed to be Mechalel Shabbat to save a life that's not a life? So Tosafot says, I don't understand why we're Mechalel Shabbat for a fetus in utero. So Tosafot says over here, Yesh Lomar, Dimikol Mokom Mishum Pikuach Nefesh Mechalelim Alav Et HaShabbat. That pikuach nefesh allows for chilul Shabbat, afal gav d'mutar lehorgo. Even if you could kill them, because, he brings an example, a goseis, person who is on the edge of dying, they are moments away from dying, that person, if he is killed, you would not be considered to be a rotzeach, because he's already basically dead, and then if you kill him, you would not be considered a rotzeach or a treifa. If you killed the treifa, you would not be subject to a death penalty. Yet, both for a goses and for a treifa were mechalel Shabbat to save their lives. Or in essence, what Tosfot says is that the din of pikuach nefesh is different than the din of tzicha. And therefore there's a distinction between them. And again, we've noted before that Rav Moshe and his tshuva brings that connection and shows through that connection that if you commit chalal Shabbat for the saving of a child, that clearly indicates the child's alive. Over here, Tosafot indicates that even though that seemingly is true, we find exceptions to that rule, and therefore there must be a different din with regards to chilul Shabbat versus what's considered to be a live entity that is considered to be murder. And that is by pikuach nefesh, v'mechalel Shabbat even ala safek, even if there's a chance of life. And so therefore, pikuach nefesh will be done even in instances where you will not be considered a hore. If there's a safek, you're not considered a murderer. But if there is a safek, you still violate Shabbat for pikuach nefesh. And that way, Tosafot differentiates between chilul Shabbat and murder. Other Rishonim say that the din of Shabbat stems from a different logic than the logic of murder. Murder has to do with an entity being alive, whereas chilul Shabbat has to do with a principle of mechalalin alav Shabbat achat, kedei shishmu Shabbatot karbei, that we mechalal one Shabbat in order to save this entity that will then can keep many more Shabbatot afterwards. Given that, the din by Shabbat, or the consideration by Shabbat, is very different than the consideration by Ritzicha. Right? Ritzicha is only Ritzicha when it's a live entity, when it's considered to be born and alive, that's when there's Ritzicha. In utero, that wouldn't be classified as Ritzicha, at least in the sense of murder. It might have other isurim or other problems, as we discussed before, but in terms of murder, it's not murder. Yet, in terms of Chilul Shabbat, we might be Mechalel Shabbat here, because we don't need to know that it's alive in order to be Mechalel Shabbat. What we need to know is that there's a chance that if we save whatever is here, that that entity might keep Shabbat in the future. And that's enough of a reason for us to be Mechalel Shabbat, irrespective of whether it's deemed a live entity. So even if the fetus in utero is not a live entity, we still be Mechalel Shabbat, because if you save this baby will keep many more Shabbatot. So Mechalim Alav Shabbat Achat, Kadesh Yishmeru Shabbatot Harbei. And in that way, the other Rishonim differentiate between Shabbat and murder. Now, the Tzitz Eliezer, in dealing with the issue of aborting, it's actually a question that was posed to him by Rav Avadya Yosef that he's responding to. Says that because the Isur here is only classified as an Isur midrabanan, that he believes that hapalat herayom, that abortion is only a din derabanan, and therefore he says there is more room to be mekil. And he says that you can consider more than simply the death of the mother in the ability to perform an abortion. It's not just when the mother's life is in danger, but even if the mother's psychological welfare would be compromised by having a baby that is problematic, in that case, there is permission or room to be mekil with regards to an abortion. He says especially within the first 40 days of pregnancy, and even up to the first 3 months of pregnancy, he sees there a lot more room in terms of doing an abortion. He does say that it should be aborted through a medicinal manner rather than via dying, doing it actively by killing the baby. But he is willing to be much more mekil. Moshe Feinstein, in responding to that tshuva, is adamant that it's incorrect, and the Isser is an Isser Doraita, and there is no permission to abort, even in situations of Tzar Ha'im, even when there's difficult psychological issues for the mother. And their controversy really extends to what was at the time an issue of Tay-Sachs, whereby if the woman knows that she's going to have a Tay-Sachs baby, can she abort the baby? Where Moshe Feinstein says, absolutely not. The Tzitz Eliezer, where he writes in following, Lezot mishnatenu bazeh lo zaza mimkoma, ema shetabdi lahatir hafsakat hereyon. I think you can terminate a pregnancy because of Tay-Sachs until the 7th month of pregnancy. And this is the Tzitz Eliezer responding to what Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote, meaning that he's aware of what Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote, and he still disagrees. And he says, I still stand by my original psak, and I disagree with Rav Moshe Feinstein with regards to this. And he really relies on our Tosafot here in Nidah, where Tosafot seems to indicate that it is mutar. So Tosafot uses the word mutar and not asur. Rav Moshe Feinstein wants to change the girsa and the Tosafot to read asur based on the Tosafot in Sanhedrin. And the Tzitz Eliezer says nobody else ever made that suggestion to reconcile the two Tosafot, and therefore he thinks that the word mutar here means literally mutar, and that if there is good reason or cause for doing such, then it would be mutar, because it is only an Isur Midrabanan and not an Isur Deoraita. And Rav Avadia Yosef seems to favor the view of the Tzitz Eliezer that's only an Isur Midrabanan. He's not as makil as the Tzitz Eliezer, but he is willing to be makil even in cases where there's no sakana, but there is makom choli. It can cause problems of sickness or disease or ailment to the woman, that would be impactful even though there's no sakana. And he says, especially before the 3-month term is up, that there is more room, midrabanan, there to be makil because of the sfeik sveika, and whether it's a din derabanan or din doraita. And if you say it's din doraita, maybe less than 3 months is only midrabanan. And therefole, in cases of choli, even though there's no sakana, he says that there can't be room to be makil if you have expert doctors, more than one, that are giving that opinion, that feel that the woman's life or health are really in danger from this baby. So this sugi over here, as well as sugi in Sanhedrin, and this Balei Tosafot, play a pivotal role in the discussion with regards to abortion. And Rav Moshe Feinstein in his tshuva discusses this extensively, both the issue of correlating between Shabbat and aborting, whether that's a determination of life or not a determination of life, as well as to whether there, even though there's no din of murder over here, is there still an Isur, and maybe even an Isur Mitzicha, that is associated with aborting, and that really stems from this Balei HaTosafot in our Gemara over here. Alright, now Gemara says, at the end of the mission, says, V'Yehuda Aviv Limol Udokol Krovav Kechatan Shalem, that he is to his mother, his father, and all his relatives like a full Chatan. What impact does that have? Amar Papa, the Inyan Aveilut. As we know to read the Mishnah, that is that they have to sit Shiva for him, that they are Avilim for this baby. Mi Keman. Who is this like? Who's the Tana that has this position? The local Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Certainly not like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Damar Kosha Shaha Shloshim Yom Badam Enu Nefel. In order to determine that a baby is a viable entity, you have to live 30 days for a human being in order to be considered a live entity and not a Nefel. In animals, it's 8 days. That's why it says Badam, it's 30 days. Ha, lo, shaha, safek avi. According to Shimon Gamliel, if you don't make it to day 30, we consider it a safek, and the individual is not necessarily classified as a live entity. So, hacha, bayaskinan. What are we dealing with in this situation? The kimle, shukalu lo, chadashav. That it's a case where they went to full term, that he finished the full 9 months, and that's why we don't worry about it. So here, the Balei Tosafot spend a lot of time on this, basically structuring what is the machloka between the Chachamim and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. And it comes out in the end that the machloka revolves around what is the determining factor as to whether a baby is considered to be a live entity or not. So the Chachamim go after your term. The duration that the baby was in the mother will be determinant. If he made it to full term, if he made it through the full 9 months, then at the point he is born, we assume him to be a full entity. We don't consider or classify him to be a nefel. And therefore, if he passes away before the 30 days are up, we would still treat him as if he was a live, fully viable entity. On the other hand, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says that there are many times that there's a nefel that is born, and therefore you have to wait 30 days to be sure that this isn't a nefel. Now, that turns out to be the chumrah over here, but in other instances, it'll turn out to be the kula, which is that if you have a baby that was carried for 8 months, which the Gemara believes that a baby carried to an 8-month term is ke'even, when it's born, it's not an entity, it's not a live entity. And so according to the sheet of the Chachamim, then this baby could be considered a nefel because it never made it to the full term of the pregnancy. And the waiting of 30 days is going to change that. On the other hand, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who says it's all determined by the number of days afterwards. If it lives for 30 days, then it's viable. Then if this baby lives for 30 days, then it's a viable entity. So what was a chumrah by the 9-month term will turn out to be a kula by the 8-month term, according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. So according to this, the machloka between them is when the baby is born, if it went to a full 9-month term, what is the status of the baby? Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says it's still be safek until we clear the 30 days. Whereas the Chachamim say that it is considered to be a viable entity, because on the robe, a baby like this will survive and be a viable entity. Now, as the Balei Tosafot would say, that if the baby dies, then the Chachamim still say, or classify him as a full entity and a live baby, Whereas Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says retroactively that shows if he died that he was a nafel. The question is, how did this baby die? If the baby dies from an ailment or an illness, then clearly Rabbi Shimon Gamliel believes that that's mareh, that he was a nafel all along because he doesn't make it through the 30 days. And the Chachamim would have to agree in that case that if the baby dies because it's not strong enough or it was ill and it doesn't make it to 30 days, then that's clearly a nafel. So the Chachamim are not going to disagree in that case. The machloket revolves around a case where the baby is suddenly killed. An animal came and ate it. It fell off a roof. Some trauma happened to the baby that killed it that had nothing to do with the viability or the wellness of the baby, but it died because of whatever accident that happened. Over there you have the machloket. The Chachamim believe that rove of these entities, where it's kalulo chadashav, are considered to be viable entities. And if that's the case, then we would consider it to be a full-fledged baby entity, and we would not classify it as a nafel. Shimon Gamliel says it's a safek. We never know. Until you clear the 30 days, we don't know. And therefore, even in this case where the baby died from trauma and looked like they would have survived past the 30 days, it's a safek. And since it's a safek, we can't determine until after we've crossed over the 30 days. So Tosafot then says, if it's so clear that the baby should survive and it was only killed because of a trauma and rogue babies survive, why does Rabbi Shimon Gamliel disagree over here? So he says that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel disagrees because it is a miut hamatsui. It is not a miut that is so small in a probability that we would just dismiss it. He says it's a miut that has a significant minority that are nephilim, and therefore he says until we have proof positive that this is a viable entity, we will consider or classify them as possibly being a nephil. And so therefore, if it's a miut ashkiach, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel believes in certain issues the chachamim will be machmir. When it comes to avelut, which in general we passed in the kula, we'll go to kula with regards to avelut. And then Tosafot says that when it comes to avelut, the Gemara in Bechorot says that yom lamed keshelefanav linyan avelut, that the 30th day is considered to be like the first 30 days and not past the 30 days for avelut, even though to say that with regards to halakha and yisurim, we're machmir, or in a sense, we consider it to be a live entity when it reaches 30 days. Yet by avelut, we are makil when it gets to day number 30. That's because we're always makil with regards to avelut. And then other rishonim point out that not only are we makil with regards to avelut, and we're dealing with a society in which infant mortality is way above 50%, then people had enough, they can't be mitabel for every child that is born and every entity that's born because there's just too much avelut going on given the high rates of mortality within the world at that time. And therefore they were makil with regards to avelut, which obviously has an impact in our day where the infant mortality rates aren't so high and whereby people consider any baby to be a precious entity of life. Then the Niyugei Avelut or the Dinim Avelut really in many ways have changed because of that, that people are mitabel over even the youngest entity, even the youngest of babies, and we don't really wait for the 30 days, and even the baby dies before that, they still have Avelut for the babies because that dynamic has changed over time. All right, next Mishnah. Bashloshim yom echad mitkadeshet v'biyah. A girl or a woman who reaches the age of 3 years in one day, then they can be nitkadesh bibiyah, meaning that their biyah is considered to be a biyah at that age. Imbalea yavam kana. And if there is a yavam, meaning that she was already married, she obviously didn't marry herself off, her father married her off, and then that husband passed away, and now the brother is coming to form yibum with her, if he has biyah with her, he's koneh her, because yibum, or the consummation of the yibum, is done through biyah. If she's married, I mean her father married her off and she's now a married woman, if a third party sleeps with her, that is considered to be adultery. And she has the ability to create tumat boel nida. Even though, as we saw in the previous mission, she can be a nida from day one, the din of boel nida only applies from the age of 3 years and one day and onward. And in that case, the boel nida becomes like the nida herself, to be mitameh, that which is below him, the same way that a zav is mitameh, those things that are above him. We already dealt with the exact explanation in the world of Tumah for this in the previous Mishnayot. Nisei the Kohen, tochal b'trumah. she's married to a Kohen, she has a right to Truma because she is of a marriageable age that can consummate a marriage because Biyah is effective. Ba'ale achad min apsulim, if any one of the disqualified individuals has Biyah with her, psula min akuna, she can no longer marry a Kohen. So if an Ovei Kochavim or an Eved sleeps with her, then that disqualifies her in the future from being able to marry a Kohen because she's then deemed to be a Zonah because she had Biyah with someone who was Pasul. Ba'ale achad mikol arayot, if one of the illicit relations in the Torah notes slept with her, they will be put to death. And she obviously is exempt because she is too young. She is onus rachmana patre. She is considered to be too young to be culpable for such an act. Never she'll be ptura. Fachot mikain, if she is less than 3 years in one day, kenotein etzba ba'ayin. It's like you put your finger in your eye. Just like when you put your finger in the eye, it causes irritation. But when you remove it, the irritation resolves. So too, with regards to a girl under the age of 3 years and one day, the impact of both her losing her betulim and her classification as biyah is not impactful at that age because the body recovers basically from it. And it's as if you put your finger into your eye, you pull it out, it all recovers. And therefore, it's not classified as biyah below that age. Darabanan. Bat gimel mitkadeshet bibiyah divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says that she has to be 3 years old in order to have kiddushin through biyah. Kamim harmim bat gimel shanim v'yom echad. 3 years and one day. May benayu. What's the nafkamina between them? What are they arguing about? Amrav debay Rabbi Yanai, Erev Rosh Hashanah ika benayu. Erev Rosh Hashanah is the difference between them, meaning one day is the difference between them. According to Rabbi Meir, if she was born on Rosh Hashanah, then 3 years later on Erev Rosh Hashanah, she would already be 3 years old, and then she would have crossed that threshold on Erev Rosh Hashanah. According to the Chachamim, you need 3 years and one day, she will not cross that threshold until she reaches the next day, which is Rosh Hashanah itself. How far you need to go into the next day in order for it to be 3 years in one day is actually a subject of Machloket Achronim. The majority of Achronim believe that you just have to go any amount into the next day, 3 years in one day, any amount into that one day, Mixitayom Kukulo, and that's enough to deem whatever age or threshold you need to be done. There are those that suggest that you need 8 by 8. You need it exactly from hour to hour. That means if she was born 9 o'clock on Rosh Hashanah, in order for it to be 3 years in one day, you'd have to get back to that 9 o'clock on Rosh Hashanah and then go just past it in order for it to be 3 years in one day. And then there is even a third opinion that you have to do 3 years and a whole day. And until you clear that whole extra day, then you're not considered to be 3 years in one day. The majority, vast majority of them believe that as soon as you enter into the next day, that's considered to be the next age. That's the way we paskin, and that's why for bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, when they cross over their 12th year and then get back to their birthday, on that birthday, as soon as we enter into the day that's their birthday, that's considered to be 12 years and one day or 13 years and one day. According to the Bei Rabbi Yanai, that's the machloket between them. It's a one-day difference in their machloket as to whether you need 3 years or you need 3 years and one day. B'yokhan amar, lamed yom b'shana, chashuvim shana, ika b'nayu. B'yokhan says, whether 30 days in a year is classified as a full year is the machloket between them. Or in essence, Rabbi Meir only requires 2 years and 30 days. Once you cross over 2 years and 30 days, that's the equivalent of being 3 years old. And that's what he means over here. Bat gimel shanim. If she is 3 years old, but it's a deemed 3 years old, that was done because she had 2 years and 30 days. Whereas the Chachamim believe you need full years. That's why they say 3 years and one day. And Ochanami, if Rabbi Meir required full 3 years, he'd also require 3 years in one day. But he doesn't require a full year. He only requires 30 days into that year to be classified as a full year. Meitave, is that really true? Bat gimel shanim, ba'afilu bat shtei shanim v'yom echad mitkadeshet. According to Rabbi Meir, not only can a three-year-old have kiddushin through biyah, but even a two-year-old and one day can have that. Rabbi Meir. It has to be at least 3 years and one day. Bishlam, other Rabbi Yochanan, I can explain this machloket in the Braita to reconcile with the previous Braita, which is just like there's a Tana who says Yom Echad B'Shana Chashuv Shana, one day in a year is considered to be a year. Achanami, Ikatana Demar, Lamed Yom B'Shana Chashuvim Shana. That 30 days in a year is considered to be a year. or in essence, the machloket between the two brightot is whether Rabbi Meir thinks that you only need one day into the next year to be considered a full year, or you need 30 days into the next year to be considered a full year. So that's the machloket between the two brightot and the sheet of Rabbi Meir. But in essence, they are the same sheet that Rabbi Meir, which Rabbi Yochanan is proposing, which is Rabbi Meir thinks you don't need a full year, you just need a portion of the year. How much? That's the machloket as to whether it's one day or 30 days. Hello, the Rabbi Yanai, Kasha. But according to Rabbi Yanai's explanation, how could ever be that 2 years and one day, according to Rabbi Meir, would be classified as being done, and you would be mitkadeshet bibiyah already at that threshold? For him, there's a one-day difference between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. It's either 3 years or 3 years and one day. Then all of a sudden, how do you have a brayta that says 2 years and one day would be okay? And therefore, Kasha, that's a big problem for Rabbi Yanai's explanation of their machloket. And it means that Rabbi Yochanan's explanation seems more viable in the sense that if it is a portion of the year is considered to be a full year, then there's a machloket about what is a portion of a year. Does it mean 30 days or does it mean one day? And that will be the machloket between the two different brayot. And Tosfot over here says, why can't you say that they actually, the Tanaim agree? And they all think that it's 2 years and one day. And when Rabbi Meir said 3 years, like the way Rabbi Yochanan explained it, meant 2 years and 30 days. Why did you say it meant 2 years and one day? The Tosafot of here claims that had it been that it was 2 years and one day, the individual wouldn't have said 3 years. You wouldn't have called one day a year. Even though you might deem one day a year, you wouldn't call one day a year. Therefore, by the mere fact that he says it's 3 years, it must be something more significant than a day into that third year. And then Tosafot asks, why don't we say the machloket here between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim is whether you need mikseh dayom kekulo or you need me'eit eit. And say that Rabbi Meir believes mikseh dayom kekulo, so as soon as you complete 3 years, enter into the next day, you already crossed the threshold. The Chachamim say you need require me'eit eit, the exact moment when you're born, you need to get back to that point in time in order to cross the threshold. And that way you can explain why they need 3 years in one day, whereas Rabbi Meir only needs 3 years. Tosafot says in the end, Veishlamar tekimlei derabbanan. The Rabbanan knew, b'misora, that they lo bo me'eit eit, that you didn't have a requirement to get back to that exact moment. And he says, in addition to that, if that is true, then even Rabbi Meir should also have said 3 years in one day, because then they're just arguing about what the one day is. Is the one day mikseh dayom kekulo, or is the one day really reaching to the me'eit eit and then crossing over that threshold? All right, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Mem Hei Amud Aleph.